Thanks, Dan. Good. Yes, I'm talking about data-driven stellar properties this morning. I'm discussing it. My voice may break down at some point because I have a cold, so then it will have to be a discussion where I can't talk. So data-driven stellar properties, what am I on about? Everybody knows, nobody's missed it, that we have lots of data. All of this multi-epoch spectra, photometry and astrometry, and we are deriving measurements from that data. Okay, abundances, ages, velocities, orbits, plus more. Okay, that's the point. With all of this data comes opportunity. Okay, so I'm taking advantage of this opportunity to use data and approaches to use good data to build models of worse data and of other data. So I can build models where I have data where I know something about, I know the properties of that data, and I can learn the properties of worse data or other data from that particularly good data. Another regime where I think there's a lot of opportunity in the data-driven approach is to build models of stellar physics or to inform models of stellar physics and learn where physical models are wrong. And I think this has been a really unexploited regime within the data-driven approach. So what I'm going to do as we go through this discussion is I'm going to go through a couple of examples. Okay, I'm going to go through how we can learn information from low signal-to-noise data using a model built on high signal-to-noise data. I'll basically sort of assert that and show that it's true. I won't go into that much detail with that. This is potentially less interesting for this crowd, but I want to demonstrate how the data-driven approach, how I built my own data-driven approach using learning chemical abundances. And particularly, I'll talk about how we can get chemical abundances of low-resolution spectra, given high-resolution spectra with stars in common. We can learn the information content of data and learn new information from data. And I'll show the example, which is probably becoming more relevant for this crowd, of ages from stellar spectra using astroseismic determinations for stars that have both astroseismology and stellar spectra. I'll talk about how we're aiming to propagate rotation periods, density, radii, stellar properties from the Kepler survey to the TESS survey, and show you the work we've done here, including new work this week on looking at that and how we want to go towards building a physical interpretation given the origin of information in data and see where data is precise and imprecise specifically for Kepler and TESS data. And again, I have a couple of plots on that. Okay, so I'm going to start with data-driven modeling of spectra. I'll go pretty quickly over this. I think a number of people have seen this. At the same time, it's important I built my data-driven approach from stellar spectra, and this is a generalizable approach that can then be used on other data, on time domain data, multi-epoch photometry, TESS, Kepler, Gaia, so on and so forth. Okay, so where is our spectral data coming from? I've worked with spectra for a very long time, and we now have this millions of spectra from a multitude of different surveys. You've probably heard about Apogee, Galago, ISO, Lemos, Segway, and so on and so forth. If you look at these surveys on the sky, RA and DEC, I've just got Galago, ISO, and Apogee. They cover different spatial extents, and they all have different targeting selections. So they have very different scientific goals, and they all have what they have in common is they have a number of stars in common, and these pipelines or these groups that survey these stars deliver radial velocities, and they deliver stellar properties, stellar parameters, or what I'll call labels, which are things like temperature, gravity, overall metallicity, and individual chemical abundances or chemical compositions for these stars. Okay, this is what these surveys do. So we heard about this from a talk last week, that labels should be an intrinsic property of a star. Okay, you have a star, it has some properties, that shouldn't change depending on how you measure that star. But these labels of temperature, gravity, metallicity, chemical composition are completely different depending on whether they're measured for the same star with the Apogee survey or the Galar survey or the Gaia-ESA survey. Okay, so they should be independent of the different analysis pipelines, but they're not, and they're not by a very large amount. Okay, the reason for this is the deliverables from these different pipelines are based on different assumptions, different input physics, and different methodologies. So they end up on very different scales. We've been in this state where we can't combine any of this data up until very recently. I'll give you an example of how bad this is. This is just the temperature of, I think, a couple of hundred stars that have been observed by two surveys, one optical survey and one infrared survey. And those surveys have each produced, in this case, the manganese abundance for each of those stars. The error bars are given. And the difference for those stars between the two surveys is on the order of 0.3 dex. And there's a temperature dependence. So you get a sort of a feel for how bad this problem is. And I could show you this for any label, for gravity, surface temperature, and it would be the same.
Are you going to be here
So this has been a long-standing and difficult technical problem to solve, that all of these surveys are on different scales. And this is something that I became very interested in a couple of years ago, in how can we address this. So the solution is really, for any survey, you have a small subset of stars where you know their labels, that is their stellar parameters, better than the other stars. Okay, so we can call this a high fidelity set of stars. These are reference stars. And the reason we might know their labels better than other objects is they might be clusters, they might be high signal to noise well-studied benchmarks. We might know other things about those stars from astroseismic information, where there's also been a revolution. So those are very valuable stars. So we can use these reference objects and their labels directly to build a data-driven model to propagate information about those objects to the rest of the survey. So this is what we did. We built a tool called the Canon. This is a data-driven approach to determine stellar parameters and individual abundances, which are collectively called labels, for stars in large surveys. So I'll show you how this works very briefly on stellar spectra, and then turn it to other problems that are potentially more relevant to this crowd. And we put this out a couple of years ago now, in 2015. So the advantages of this approach, the big one, and what it was really developed for, is that it's a data-driven approach, and it's therefore the first method that really enables all of these different spectroscopic surveys to be directly cross-calibrated or put on the same stellar label scale, given stars in common between surveys. So that's important. At the moment, we've got full sky coverage of 1 million stars on the same scale. This million number can be scaled up to however many stars are observed. We found that it delivers 2 to 3 times smaller errors than other approaches, and that implies that we can get away with a quarter to a ninth less observing time or obtain more stars. And this has basically been the backbone or the motivation for Sloan 5's Galactic Genesis Survey, where we're going to get 5 million stars in the disk at a fraction of the signal to noise of its predecessor survey, Apogee, but we can get the same precision as is currently being obtained by high signal to noise spectra in the Apogee survey. So we're able to get 5 million stars as opposed to a couple of 100,000 stars at the same precision. Okay, it's also opened up new avenues in galactic archaeology. I'm not going to talk about high precision for chemical tagging. I am going to talk about ages from stellar spectra and building models of time-varying brightness variations. We're going to build models for things like granulation. Good.
So, but across calibration, you presumably have to assume that one of these is true.
Correct.
Which one is it? And how do you decide? Which one of these surveys that are all on different scales?
Right? It's fairly, when you're using a higher resolution versus a lower resolution, we always take the higher resolution survey.
Okay.
That generally has the best labels. But once you can also evaluate how good those labels are in this approach by how well it recovers them, and how well your model matches your data, because it's pretty interpretable, which I'll show. Okay, so how do we do this? We take our reference stars in the survey and we know their labels. Again, these labels can come from anywhere. There are two rules that the stars have to abide by for this approach to work. Stars with the same labels have to have the same spectra, so it's not degenerate. And the flux has to vary smoothly with labels for this particular data engineering choice anyway. So we use our N reference objects with our L labels to build a model, and this is the training step. At this point, it's related to machine learning. So we have our flux of our N reference objects at every pixel or every wavelength value is equal to some function of our labels, L, for all of our training stars, N, or our reference objects, N, given our spectral model, which are called theta, at every wavelength. So we have a spectral model that we solve for at every wavelength, plus some noise. So in practice, these become temperature, gravity, metallicity abundances, whatever you want to learn. This is a spectral model. This becomes a choice. I'll show you the choice that we made. It's a very simple spectral model. And we also have noise that incorporates the photon noise plus the fit of the spectral model. We optimize allowing for the canon to learn how well we can predict these labels given our choice of model. Okay, good. So all that we're doing is relating our labels L to our stellar flux at every wavelength and solving for a set of coefficients. Okay, same equation again. So we have our training step with our known labels. This is what it turns into, or it can turn into, for a linear choice of our model. So in this case, we have our flux again with some coefficients, which are our spectral model, which we're solving for, multiplied by our labels for each of our n training stars, plus some noise. Yeah?
So will those parameters be different for each survey?
They are, so we take, they are different for each survey, but we just take some reference objects. So what do you mean different?
So I guess my picture of this was that you had your reference objects mm-hmm. where you know their labels from somewhere else, and then also each survey has looked at those reference objects.
Ignore what that survey says about it. So we don't worry what that survey says. You just take, you want to take some as the ones you're going to use. Like you take some labels, doesn't matter what the survey says about those stars.
But the survey is providing its spectra.
The survey is providing its spectra. So say this is the survey is providing this flux, this spectra, and these can come from anywhere.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That's they can come from within the survey or external to the survey.
How do you deal with this restriction?
Oh, it has to be shifted back. This is assuming everything is shifted back to rest frame.
So you have to measure the velocity first.
You have to measure the velocity first and have everything shifted back. Once everything's shifted back, then you have basically you're solving for a coefficient at every wavelength and how that's changing with each of your different labels. You're solving for that simultaneously.
And you have to pixel the same grid as well.
Exactly. So everything has to be interpolated onto the same grid. That could be the front end of this, but this is all assuming that's done. So, yeah, exactly.
How do you handle telluric lines?
Sorry?
Telluric lines?
So we take into account the error on each flux, so where the tellurics are, the error is very high. So that basically makes the weighting of those lines really small. So it's important to have an accurate error model, or you would need to mask those sort of things out. Good. So in the training set, we solve for those different coefficients. We've solved for our A, B, C, D. And now at test step, we have the rest of the stars in our survey where we know our flux, we know our coefficients, and we solve for our stellar parameters. They're on exactly the same scale as our reference objects. Okay, so in reality, we don't use this model. We use a quadratic model. That simply means we have temperature squared, gravity squared, velocity squared, and the cross terms in there as well, which means we solve for 10, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, up to 10, rather than 4 coefficients. This actually does work if you just use very weak lines. Stellar physics. Lines are not linear as a function of the labels as you go to stronger and deeper lines. Okay, I'll show you the Apogee example to show you how well this works. A lot of my collaborators were surprised by how well this works. The data release this year is actually 350,000 stars, but it's been run for now up to 250,000 stars. We developed the canon using a training set of 540 open and globular cluster stars where we took the labels from Apogee's pipeline. ASCAP, the labels had been corrected based on where stars should live, based on the fact that they were known globular and open cluster candidates. And we took only 3 labels, temperature, gravity, and metallicity. This is our training set, temperature on the x-axis, gravity on the y-axis, for each of our individual clusters ordered by metallicity, going from metallicities of minus 2.35 up to 0.5 dex. So almost all of the stars lie on the red giant branch, except for the Pleiades cluster, which just lives here. So I'm going to show you that we do well on the red giant branch, poorly on the main sequence, because we have very few reference objects there, which is relevant to the necessity for a good reference object or training set. So essentially we use these objects to solve for our 10 coefficients, just for the presentation, I'm just writing the 4, and our noise term as well. And our test set that we tested this on was the 120,000 stars that were available from Apogee at the time. Because the canon is a generative model, when we run the stars at test time, we can use the output labels, so the temperature, gravity, metallicity in this case, to generate the model spectra. And we've done this here for stars that are not in the training set, but stars in the test set, for four different stars, just looking at two different wavelength regions. The star is in black and the model is in blue. So you can see that with three labels, we are remarkably well predicting the spectra. And this is telling you something about the dimensionality of the chemical abundant space, which is something that I'm looking at now. It turns out that's very low, which if you get put in 20 abundances, you get a marginally better fit to the spectra, but you do remarkably well with just metallicity, temperature, and gravity. Good. The Apogee results. This is for the temperature and gravity plane. This is the isochrones at different metallicities shown with the 540 training stars. And now I'll show you where our test stars fall. So this is our 120,000 stars run through the canon. We do really well on the red giant branch. We differentiate red giant branch from main sequence stars, but we do less well just because we have basically no trading stars there. And I'll show you in Galar how when we have more trading stars in this regime, we do a lot better. Okay, so good, everything works very well. I'm going to now assert that we do much better at low signal to noise than traditional approaches by showing you the traditional approach, which is ASCAP. This is representative of physics-based pipelines. It does a very good job. On the x-axis, I have the signal to noise of individual visit spectra. Apogee doesn't look at a star once, it looks at a star multiple times to accumulate the required signal to noise. They were going for, I believe, a signal to noise of 100 for all of their stars in their survey to give them about 0.1 to 0.5 dex precision on most of their abundances. So here on the y-axis, I'm looking at the RMS result for metallicity of the combined from the multiple observations compared to the individual visit spectra. So that gives you an assessment of your precision as a function of signal to noise. So that's how well ASCAP is doing, and that's how well we do with the canon. So we're doing a lot better. It basically means that we can get our precision of 0.1 dex at a signal to noise of about 25 compared to 60. So that's a significant improvement that we've found. Okay. One of the, I think, most useful aspects of a simple model, a simple data-driven approach like this, is that the model is interpretable. So if we look at the zeroth coefficient of the model, the A lambda term, and so lambda, and plotting all the different lambdas, the A lambda term is the zeroth coefficient. It's kind of like the mean spectra. And then all of our coefficients that went in front of all of our labels, they correspond directly to how much that particular label depends on the flux. So here I'm plotting just a small wavelength region in the Apogee spectra, the zero coefficient, which is like the mean spectra, around the bracket feature, the hydrogen bracket feature, and the different coefficients. And you can see that the log G coefficient screams up around the bracket feature, and the log G coefficient is highest around the bracket feature. And this has been very convincing to stellar spectroscopists in particular that this approach is not, that this approach has merit, in that we can discover in the spectra where the largest label dependencies are, because gravity is known to be very dependent on this particular feature. And I'll come back to this when I'm looking at the time domain data in a few slides.
So what you might be getting this, but like what do the data know, I guess, that the model didn't? Like, primarily, why is it performing so much better? Is it
then what you mean, why do we get higher precision?
Yeah.
We think part of it is just that we're taking like the noise model into account, that we're taking into account the error on every pixel when we generate those coefficients. So we have a proper weighting at every pixel. The normalization is also important. We're not doing a traditional normalization because we don't have to for this. Our normalization doesn't have to be at this flux level of 1. That is required for the stellar models. So there's also that.
So you fit to the non-continuum normalize?
We continuum normalize. I can go into how we do that, but it doesn't have to abide by these particular rules that you know, when they compare to model spectra, it has to be at this value of 1. And the way it's done at the moment in APT is signal-to-noise dependent, so the normalization level changes just marginally, but it's enough to cause a blow-up in the precision a bit as well. So
the other reason, I mean, if you do traditional spectroscopic analysis, you only take certain lines, right? Mm. You don't take the whole spectrum. You choose your lines that you think you know best that actually give sensitivity to various parameters, but you fit the whole spectrum.
We fit the whole spectrum. Strangely, we get high precision even when we don't know. So even when
you
we just
take the same lines that the spectral synthesis does,
yeah, we still get that precision. So, which is a little bit, that shouldn't necessarily be the case, but it is.
Sorry, Mary. So you said it's normalization is done in this, before to this. But yeah, you said it's a different signal to noise may drive different location of the continuum. So it doesn't affect your model?
No, the way we do the signal to noise, the way we do the continuum normalization, we ensure is signal to noise independent. We do it so that the signal to noise is not changing the level.
Yeah. But how you ensure that it's
affected? Oh, it's just a way that, so in Apogee, they do it by doing some, they make some percentile and they make some running percentile where they take the top 10% or something, and that becomes signal noise dependent, whereas we choose exactly the same pixels every time.
Yeah.
Which means that it's not entirely flat, but it, but that doesn't matter, that it's not entirely flat, because the model's built from the data, and then it's just propagated on in the exact same way. As long as you do the signal noise continuum normalization, I mean, the continuum normalization consistently between reference and test set, it doesn't matter really what you do. Yeah, if that makes sense. Okay. This has been not exploited, but we can basically look where models diverge from the data. I'm showing here a couple of different stars just across different wavelength regions, or this may be one star, sorry, across different wavelength regions. And what I'm showing is the ASCAP model, which is in the dashed line, the Canon model in red, and the data in black. So the ASCAP model is actually fantastic. These physical models of stars are, or physics-driven models of stars are really good. The deviations are really tiny, but significant enough, I think, to lead to lower precision. And you can see that the Canon's model is basically an exact match of the data. These are not stars, again, that are used in the test. These are stars only in training. Something that Apogee has a problem with is getting the gravity correct of the red clump. They find offsets with respect to the astroseismic observations. And this is the bracket feature again, which is the most gravity-sensitive feature. And you can see the Apogee model, which is in the dashed line, deviates from the stellar spectra and the Canon's model in red and black. So I actually think this is the source.
So what is different in the clump stars and the RGB stars?
I don't know what's different, but Apogee does an empirical correction because there's something, some offset with their red clump stars.
I mean, because these offsets should come from something different in the spectra, right? In the RGB or the clump. But they are so close in temperature that it's difficult to come up with a physical interpretation.
Yeah. Okay. I want to quickly advertise or show the Galar survey, because I don't think the survey's been particularly utilized yet. And they're having another data release in about the end of this year. And it may be relevant. They have a number of getting planet candidates and that sort of thing in there. They have stars, 350,000 stars all over the main sequence and red giant branch. Sven has been responsible for this data release. He's used the Canon to derive 23 element abundances in both the red giant and the main sequence. I just want to show you what the spectra looks like because it's a very beautiful spectra. This is the red giant star. This is the main sequence star. Galar is the optical. It covers a really broad wavelength range, 4,000. 8,000 angstroms. This is a zoom in of this little region for the red giant and for the main sequence star. And you can see the Canon's model and the data really beautifully overlap. And the residuals are blown up by a factor of 5. And we can do this consistently across the main sequence and the red giant as long as we fit 4 V sin I. And then it all works. Okay. So now I've shown you how I've built the data-driven approach and some of the choices I've made. Those choices are flexible. You can make more complicated models, and so on and so forth. So far, We've just started to actually develop more complicated approaches or more sophisticated approaches, working with some students, and I'll show you, but I wanted to show you how we've started to turn this towards astroseismology. I'll start with just how we have transferred labels from astroseismology to stellar spectra. In galactic archaeology, I'm really interested in how the Milky Way is formed. I'm just basically doing this so I can get my measurements from stars to try and infer something about the galaxy. So it's been a really big challenge to get consistent and precise chemical compositions and ages across the Milky Way. We've now made, I think, good steps towards that aim because we can put all these different surveys on the same abundance scale. And due to astroseismology, we've been able to propagate astroseismic ages to stars across the Milky Way disk. Okay, the critical link has been whoever in Apogee decided to observe stars that were in Kepler. Are you part of that originally?
Mark Pinson.
Mark Pinson. Okay.
Person of Ohio State.
Okay. That's a really good idea.
Yeah. It also happened to be that the Apogee footprint like almost exactly matches one of the Kepler CCDs. So that's
another It all worked out. Yeah. That's been pretty fantastic. So of course we can get ages for small nearby faint samples. Guy's going to provide here, and astroseismology enables us to get thousands of stars in particular locations in the sky using getting the stellar mass and going to stellar age, given stellar metallicities. So we can get ages here due to the discriminating power in stellar models. We can get ages here due to the internal oscillation frequencies that can be measured out of the astroseismic power spectra. Okay, so again, precise ages from astroseismology for thousands of stars. Now, stars with precise ages that also have spectra can be used to build this data-driven model to infer ages from stellar spectra itself, given information being in the stellar spectra. It's not magic, it's only going to work, of course, if the information is there. So because we can now measure ages for giant spectroscopically, and I'll show you how well we do okay, not as well as astroseismology. We've gone from this regime change from stars in the solar neighborhood to having large vast age maps for the Apogee survey, which cover from, that's heading towards the galactic center and beyond, targeting Sagittarius, that's around the sun, you know, from around the sun through to the disk, all the way to the bulge. I think most people in here are aware of this work from Marie Martigue that showed that due to mass-dependent dredge up, the carbon to nitrogen ratio shown on the x-axis as a function of metallicity changes as a function of stellar age for the stars by combining the Apocalypse stars, which are stars with astroseismic masses and ages, with the Apogee stars, which have the carbon to nitrogen abundance measurements. And this is due to mass-dependent dredge up. So this is understood physically as well. So we're able to take advantage of the carbon to nitrogen in the Apogee spectra to essentially learn stellar ages. We did this with the exact same infrastructure as what we'd used on Apogee, what we used as Galar, the same quadratic model. I've taken now 6,000 red giant stars that are in Apogee that are also observed by Kepler, taken their mass labels from the latest catalogue of Pinsano, and I used that to create a model with the canon describing how flux varies with these 5 labels. The first labels I just took from Apogee's stellar abundance and parameter pipeline, ASCAP, and this label I took from the astroseismic catalogue. Okay, once we have that model, we can then deploy that on the rest of the Apogee giants. There are more than 200,000. About 150,000 came out in a parameter space that was representative of the reference stars. So that means we can make go to mass to age with stellar evolution models. I learned mass, not age. And this is basically what age looks like when we go to mass to age for the 150,000 stars from Apogee. This is a galactic center, 5 kiloparsec beyond the galactic center, out to 15 kiloparsec in the disk. Height from the plane, 0, so in the mid-plane, plus or minus 4 kiloparsec. This is not representative of density, it's just covering the entire Apogee footprint, so you get an impression for how young stars in the disk, older stars in the disk. You were asking about flaring, right, the other day? Yeah, so you can see in the ages, I think, the flaring. Yeah, so that's really beautiful. And unfortunately, I'd love to get a few more stars in this regime because the ages in the bulge are really interesting. And I think that'll come with the next Apogee data release, which is not public. When is that?
Hmm?
When's the next Apogee data release?
September.
September?
December.
December. Does that have all the bulge stars?
Yeah.
has all everything that was observed through end of last summer.
Oh, that's great. Okay, good. The ages are precise to about 40%, so when you make mean age maps, it looks really nice. individually, you can differentiate young and old, and intermediate, I think is fair to say.
So is there a reason why you train on mass and not on age directly? It sounds like if you train on mass and then you go from mass to age, you're going from mass to age, or using new models twice, because the seismology also needs models to go from mass.
Yeah, but training on age implies that you become more model dependent, right? Because, for example, if you have mass loss, you will get different ages for the same mass. Right? So, in a sense, mass is more fundamental. So, I don't know if that's a reason why you achieve doing it, but you will get very different ages for the same mass, right?
Yeah, but mass loss shouldn't be a huge thing for the right concept.
I gave a few talks to astroseismologists where I trained on age, and they gave me a hard time. Sorry, that's my reason. So I agreed I would train on mass and then go to age because mass was more fundamental. So I was happy to do that. But it doesn't matter so much. Actually, there are some that are different, and I don't understand that. I've just put that in my aside. I'm now going to talk about turning the time or the data-driven approach to time domain data, TESS, Kepler, eventually Gaia, LSST. Okay, this is our project Lightcurve Canon. I've called us the PIs because we got a little grant to do this, Dan and myself. That grant basically means that we can pay for students to come here, so that's good. The aim of this is to make a detailed mapping of time domain variability to fundamental parameters. So we want to learn temperature and luminosity across this entire space to see if we can from stellar brightness variations. We're going to use Kepler data, Gaia magnitudes, and then basically we want to not only do this, make a physical interpretation of where this works, why this works, how well this works, where, and then if we can learn this, this is applicable for surveys like LSST where our stars will be very, very faint. So here we're working with, I'm working with Ruth this week to do this, as well as three students, Mariam Saeed, Kirsten Mankara, Adam Wheeler. They're all turning up, Mariam, Kirsten, Adam. They're all turning up here on Monday. So they're really excited. Please talk to them if you see them. Tell them things that you think about any of this project or what's important to know. Just talk to them, that'd be great. Part of this project was motivated by a paper that we wrote with a number of collaborators in this room, I don't think I've missed anyone, on the inference of stellar parameters from brightness variations last year, using the data-driven approach. Basically, I was interested, okay, data-driven approaches, they're really useful to assess the information content in the data. I was reading all these papers that were getting ages and masses from Kepler, but they were getting their temperature from external sources and different sources depending on the catalogs. So I wanted to know, can we derive consistently just from the brightness variations itself? Do we have to rely on spectroscopy? Which gives, you know, the spectroscopy, there's only 5% overlap with current data, so there's not that much overlap. And the temperature scale is important for consistent mass determinations. It's used in the scaling relations. And currently, the most precise temperature is coming from the spectral overlap. So I thought this seemed like an interesting problem to look at. So for this, we just looked at the red giant branch. Okay, we modeled the time domain data by using the Canon to make a model with labels of temperature, gravity, metallicity, nu max, and delta nu. These came from Apogee Spectra. These came from a catalog of Yu et al. And what we found, and I'll show you, is that we can learn temperature from the brightness variations itself to a precision that's as good as the spectroscopy. So that's important for having consistent temperature scale for all of your Kepler stars. How do we do this? We downloaded 2,000 spectra from the Kepler database and just divided that up into a training and a test set. These in the frequency domain, these covered from a nu max of 5 to about 250, just to give you a sense of what this looked like. I downloaded the power spectra, and then for the Canon to work, you need your variations to be smooth in amplitude. You can't have your stellar property variations changing as a function of the x-axis direction. This is just an engineering decision of the canon. This is not a comment about generically how things need to be framed. This is just for the infrastructure I had. I needed my variations to be this way, not that way. So I converted this back to the time domain using the inverse Fourier transform, creating the autocorrelation function. So once I had that autocorrelation function for my 1,000 training stars, I looked at the autocorrelation function and I looked at individual pixels of the autocorrelation function, where here I'm showing four. For each of my labels, temperature, gravity, U max, delta nu, metallicity. So what you can see, this basically is the first step I always do if I'm going to do data-driven inference. I see if the information is in the spectra on a pixel-by-pixel level. Typically plot every pixel and just look at it. So you can see that for all of these labels, there's a relationship between the amplitude of the autocorrelation function and the labels. And this is for single pixels. You get a really strong relationship. The structure is really quite interesting for nu max and delta nu. But this can approximately be fit by a quadratic model. And a quadratic model is clearly not the best choice, I don't think, because of the different structure going on. But we thought we'd try it and see how it worked. As soon as I saw this, I threw away metallicity, because I don't think you can learn metallicity given it looks like a blob.
I'm sorry, Melissa, what is the y-axis?
So this is the autocorrelation function, amplitude. So I took the log of it.
Can you explain what you mean by pixel?
Oh, like every data point? Like you have your x data points of your autocorrelation
function. Every time delay?
Time delay. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so every time delay point. I should use a better word. Lots of people ask what I mean by pixel. Lag. I get, yeah, in time delay, my H time delay lag. So when we used a quadratic model through all the normal infrastructure that I had in it, using my four labels for my 1,000 test stars, it's a generative model. Again, you can just generate the model given the results you have at test time for these four labels. So that's what I've done. This is two real stars in blue with different stellar properties, and the model is shown in black with the scatter of the model around it in gray. So that represents how accurate or how precisely you're predicting the flux, or the autocorrelation flux at that particular time lag. So you can see that we do not capture the detailed structure in any way. This model is inadequate, clearly. That presumably means something. Doesn't know. presumably all of this is meaningful, except Dan indicated that's probably not meaningful. It's probably noise, right?
Yeah.
Nevertheless, despite the fact our model is bad, this is our reference labels on the x-axis, the canon's output labels on the y-axis. We learn temperature to less than 100 Kelvin, gravity to less than 0.1, and we also learn nu max and delta nu, obviously less well than you do if you just use the power spectrum. It's related to the flicker method. So good, we were happy. This works with a quadratic model. It takes a second or two to deploy on thousands of stars, and it's relevant for just this, I think, this huge onslaught of data. So we're happy with this little proof of concept. Worked on the red giant branch. There's also been a paper by Neil Deacon for red giant stars, getting data-driven stellar parameters for 100,000 stars. He's gone from stellar colors to stellar parameters, and also radii to less than 10%.
So, Melissa,
the
standard approach in astroseismology is you measure delta nu and nu max, and then if you want to solve for mass and radius, you also need to measure temperature. Right? So there's basically a mass, a radius, and a temperature of a star.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to solve for all three of those things, you need three measurements. So you need three measurements. If I think of it that way, you sort of need three measurements just from your light curve in order to measure all those properties.
Okay.
So
just get three?
I'm guessing your third measurement is the granulation that's really coming in. Because from this analysis, you'll sort of get some measure of delta nu and nu max, I'm guessing, and then also the granulation signal would be sort of like a third measurement that you think the model's walking onto. I'm just trying to understand how it actually
I think we want to answer that, this meaning. Not right now.
Part of it is that if you measure log G on the giant branch, you already have a pretty good idea of what the temperature was at the giant branch.
close. Uh-huh. Right, so the granulation and the amount, so whatever is in your other correlation that it's learning, the two zero could have log G. Log G of 1 or 3.5. I mean, I guess it depends on metallicity, but in some ways you already know you have some information on the temperature based on that alone. Mm-hmm. I think that's, but I agree, based on that argumentation alone, it should have worked out well.
Yeah. And also, if that was it, part of it, I think there'd be degeneracies between other properties like mass.
Yeah, the width of the jet branch, yes.
Branch changes.
What's the width? I have no idea. The typical width of the RGB in terms of effective temperature? So take a cut that
45 to 5500?
Not in your results, I mean. Oh. I mean in the observations, right? So, you see if this cutter that you get here is comparable to the width. Maybe what Danny says is just log G and then...
I think we'll back to the HR diagram. Yeah.
Did I have a HR diagram?
Yeah, the one from our proposal.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Seems wider.
Yeah.
So at a given RGE or y-axis value, it seems wider than 100 Kelvin.
But if you look at the autocorrelation...
Where am I going?
If you look at the autocorrelation as functional gravity, oh, the structure is very similar, right? The one in temperature and built in max.
Yeah.
So that tells me that those two are correlated with temperature.
They're all correlated. Actually, I can show you. I can not answer this, but if I move on. My student Kirsten has been looking at this. She's been using variational inference and neural networks to make this more sophisticated. I got her to remake the plot. She's also learning carbon and nitrogen, but just did a few more values. And I was hoping someone could tell me why the new max and delta nu has this gorgeous structure in it. What does that mean?
So.
And like the temperature has some pretty cute structure.
What is the x-axis?
Oh, so the x-axis is scaled. Scaled everything, like to the different magnitudes of the labels, and then the y-axis is the scaled autocorrelation function.
And then one question. So at the log G is typical of a red clamp. Do you see that the temperatures that you get somehow reproduce? Broadening on the...
I don't know. I didn't look at that in detail. I should look at that. That's a good idea. So nobody knows what that's about?
I'm wondering, since you're looking at a fixed time delay, maybe it's the interference between the different modes in the ACF that has... So that you may get destructive and constructive interference, and perhaps that's what causes that structure. Just from looking at ACFs, that kind of reminds
me.
Something along those lines sounds very interesting.
Does that mean as you move around the parameter space, this structure will move around at the different time lag?
I don't know, actually. That'd be interesting to see.
Okay, I see. So interference from the different modes.
Okay. I'm speculating ahead of that.
That's a good
say it looks kind of similar to some ACFs.
I see.
Yeah. At certain delays, you get constructive interference between the different components of the chromatin.
I wonder if that's what's happening. Okay, we should try and figure out if that's what's happening. Kirsten also is looking at so this is a log time lag again, and she has the correlation coefficient of the ACF with different labels. So it basically tells you how that correlates with the ACF and also with each other. So this is carbon and nitrogen down the bottom, and then temperature, and then log G, nu max, and delta nu. So temperature is different from gravity because the correlation structure is different. And you can also see the fact the highest correlation structure means it's most correlated to least correlated. You learn it the best, essentially. Also, nu max and delta nu look, do you expect them to look almost identical?
Yeah, they're a function of each other.
Yeah, they look good. Do you understand why the log G diverges from the nu max and delta nu at this point?
I need to start thinking in ACF.
Okay. We can convert it out of this space. But something I'd like to do when the students are here is to understand exactly, to tie this back to some sort of physical interpretation of what's happening here. Why is that anti-correlated? Why can we learn carbon so better than nitrogen? Why is the amplitude offset like this? Presumably this all has reasons.
Okay, so what apparent magnitudes does the sample span, and does it seem to break down?
We haven't, because this is overlap between apogees, so it spans H of 7 to 12. So is that, do you consider that broad?
I guess I'm more familiar with the Kepler magnitudes.
Okay. I could look at what fraction of Kepler magnitudes that spans to give you a...
Typically goes down to 14.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Why
I didn't see it. Sorry. I didn't think it worse as a function of magnitude. I checked that.
Why is such a perfect overlap between delta nu and the max?
Yeah, that's what I was curious about, that apparently they're just they're a function of each other.
They are not that close, right? It's temperature is in between, right?
Yeah.
So there's a temperature difference. I mean, there's no dependence of temperature.
It could be coming. There could be, essentially, it's not quite the same because she's using a neural network, but if you put in cross terms, it might come out in the cross terms what they're different, or the squared. Like, this isn't fully representative of the correlation space, is what I'm trying to say. So it may be that they're not identical in every representation.
It's strange that log G and nu max are more different between themselves than nu max and delta nu.
I thought,
so if, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
The orange one would be the red one, and that would make more sense. It would be flipped in terms of...
Oh. I'll check she didn't make an error. I'll ask her. Can I move on? So in the last just couple of days, we've been looking with Ruth at if we can learn parameters in the main sequence. Particularly when I presented the previous results on the red giant branch about the temperature, there's a lot of skepticism how I'm learning it, and people would say you're never going to learn temperature on the main sequence. So that's sort of partly true, partly not true, I think. So starting with this particular part of the HR diagram, we downloaded a set of stars from McQuillan with temperature and rotation labels. This is bad. This is being done really quickly, just throwing it into the infrastructure. So it's temperature from the catalog versus inferred temperature from the canon, rotation period from the catalog versus rotation period from the canon. We can learn temperature. This is the chi-squared of the data minus the model, so the model doesn't fit the data very well. We'll probably choose a better model. Nevertheless, there seems to be a pretty good correlation. We're learning temperature. I noticed that this is where granulation extends to. We learn the rotation periods badly. Nevertheless, I think from looking at the ACF pixel correlation, the information is in there. I think we should be able to get it out when we improve the model. Moving down to this part of the HR diagram, the model is now much better fit to the data, but the temperature information isn't in the data. So we can learn no temperature. For the places where our model fits the data well, we learn the period very well, and then it just blows up as our model becomes a worse fit to the data, but this is just a couple of proof of concepts Ruth and I have been working on this week. So we're very hopeful at least to learn rotation period and temperature along here to some point. And then Dan has motivated the scientific basis of basically showing where the granulation signature switches off, right? Which I presume
makes perfect sense to me. It doesn't matter.
Okay.
Just that if you have the temperature, again, I think it's being traced by gravity, which you learn from the granulation. Mm-hmm. But the granulation amplitude, as you go to, I mean, all of the convection-driven signal scales with luminosity. So if you go down in luminosity and envelope, you won't be able to pick up granulation. You won't be able to pick up oscillations. But you stop picking it up, at least from Fabian Christian's work, around K-type stars. That's when you don't detect it even with Kepler anymore. So you stop detecting the granulation, you stop being sensitive to temperature based on the
log
G. And that's
what you see. I see. Yeah, we'd like to make some sort of physical model of that, for sure. I've only got a couple more slides. I wanted to show you what Adam's done because it relates to a project Ben Monte and I are working on. There you are. Hi, Ben. And also, I think it's also, Adam's got all these results and we don't know what to do with it. So if you have ideas, that would be great. I'm going to go over this super fast. This is putting two surveys on the same scale. You have two surveys, A and B, use the stars in common, use the spectra from one, labels from the other, propagate the labels to the other survey by building a model on the spectra of the other survey. Did that make sense? We did this with Apogee and Lamost, Apogee high resolution survey. We trust the labels. Survey A, 10,000 stars in common. Lamost, resolution 1800. We don't trust the labels, but we use the spectra to build a spectral model propagating the labels from Apogee and Lamost. Anna Ho did this for 500,000 Lamost stars, putting them on the Apogee scale for stellar parameters in carbon and nitrogen. She used carbon and nitrogen so we can get stellar age. Labels from Lamost versus labels propagated from Apogee. So we get a much, she just did this for the red giant stars, we get a much neater temperature gravity space for the Lamost stars. She put that out in the catalog. Okay, she got alpha enhancement as well. I just want to show you what it means to combine surveys. This is the Apogee survey. This is the bulge over here, the plain halo, slow chemical enrichment, fast chemical enrichment. Now adding the Lamost stars to that, you get this beautiful filling in at the sky. So this is the point. Now I'm working with Adam Wheeler at Columbia. He's taken the Galar survey rather than the Apogee survey because that has more interesting stellar abundance labels, and has propagated the Galar survey labels to Lamost. This is two stars that are the same in Galar and in Lamost. The model and the data are both shown. I'm zooming in around the lithium line in these two subpanels. Okay, so the lithium line in Apogee, you can see where you can learn that well. You can learn that using traditional spectroscopic approaches of equivalent width fitting, however you want to do it. In Lamost, it looks like noise. So we need a mathematical model enabled to learn the relationship between the flux and the lithium value, but we can do that. We're learning the lithium abundance from this sort of signal. How do we know that we're doing that? We just use cross-validation. Stars where we know the lithium abundance in Galar, this is their measurement, but haven't been used in the model, versus what we're inferring from the canon. So they cover a range of 0 to 2 dex enhancement in lithium, and we get a scatter of about 0.3. It's the main sequence. That's the red giants. So Adam has things like, and this is relevant, so we can learn individual abundances because we can take advantage of the fact we're building a mathematical model and don't need to rely on equivalent width, so on and so forth. So Adam is learning the lithium. He's got lithium for hundreds of thousands of stars now. One of the things that we're looking at doing at this is with Ben Monte. Andy Casey put out a paper where he had also discovered a bunch of lithium-rich stars in Lamost, 2,000, which is, I think, a factor of 10 higher than previously before. He makes a very strong prediction. This is basically all the stars in grey, his lithium-rich stars in this coloured panel zoomed in from the HR diagram. He also just did a little trick to show which were core helium-burning stars as they separate in these astroseismic parameters, which are shown in this panel. But the main takeaway from his paper was that because these are distributed across the red giant branch, lithium can't be being generated at some particular evolutionary state. It has to be some other, which is sort of the leading theory. Rather, he proposed it's due to tidal interaction with binaries. So he makes a strong prediction that most stars that are lithium-rich should be in binaries. So Ben and I are looking at Lamost-rich giants in TESS to get the distribution of rotation periods to see if that's dissimilar to a reference sample and if we have this prediction about faster rotation from this paper. So if there's anything else you think is interesting to do with lithium, if there's any signatures of planet accretion in stars that you know we'll care about that rely on individual abundances, we have abundances for 4 million stars, mostly in the outer disk. So we're looking for customers to do something with this.
Is there any way you can get any handle on radial velocity variations of any of these stars? Because the other prediction is a lot of these should be radial velocity variable.
Lamost has observed them a couple of times, so we're looking at that for some of them, not all of them.
Okay, that would be great. What about for ones that only have one epoch? Is there some way you can get a handle on if it has an anomalous radial velocity? I don't know. Based on comparison to nearby stars or something. I don't know. Is there any way the canon can do that?
I can't think of a way.
Okay.
But yeah, that would be the other.
You mean anomalous compared to the average?
Average star in that part of the galaxy. I don't know how it would actually do it, but you know, the radial velocity shifts can be tens of kilometers per second.
So oh, right.
It could be enough that they do sort of stick out relative to nearby stars.
Over what time period?
Oh, probably, in this scenario, probably over years. Like the orbital periods would be months or years or something. But the point is that they might, if you just have one spectrum, it would have, you know, a radial velocity that was 30 kilometers per second different than other nearby stars.
It's going to be true for all the nearby stars.
What's the dispersion? What's the typical radial velocity dispersion?
Of the disk?
Of, yeah. Is it much?
40, depending on which disk you're looking at.
It's about 40.
20 or 40.
So that's actually comparable to the signal we're thinking about here.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, no, maybe it's hopeless, but.
I like the idea. There's enough stars to do statistical arguments like 2,000.
You can also take a telescope and look at the stars.
Yeah.
You are crazy. Yeah, you suggested that. Yeah, we'll look at the telescope. I've only got a couple more slides. I'm not going to talk about learning evolutionary state, but you can do it. If you look at Keith Hawkins' paper, he does that. And it also, I think, it means we can learn evolutionary state from Gaia RVS, which would be cool to identify all the red clump stars in Gaia RVS. Another cool thing about data-driven approach, we're really worried in Sloan 5 because we're getting, this is a Sloan 5 footprint sun, 8 kiloparsec away. We're targeting all these bright giants in Sloan 5 to get this really beautiful disk coverage. That's great, except if your distance errors are like 40, 50, 60%. But with spectrum of photometric distances, with the data-driven approach, ELIS, and also now, Lunig and Bobi have determined that they can work out a method to get distances to red giant stars in the order of 10%. So that means over here, we have distances of 10%. That's really important for Sloan 5. Gale is the one to talk to about this, but I remember this is an example of me doing science on the internet. I was basically, all of these 0 to 3,000 represent a star. I've ordered them in terms of height from the plane, basically in the midplane, higher up from the plane, and this is just the residual of the data minus the Cannon's model. And then I'm using pixels. This is really just taken straight from my test. I didn't beautify it in any way. But this is just pixels. Around the pixel of 8,000, I was getting this weird residual that was moving in this weird way. When I looked at the wavelength of that, it was 1.527 micron. I typed that into Google and that paper came up. So that was thrilling. That it's the strongest dip in the H band, which means that's why it's going away as you move its interstellar dust, of which there's a lot of dust in the plane. It goes away as you move away from the plane. So Gail's done work on that and has also worked with a student where they use the Cannon to do the data minus model to get the dip residual.
Yeah, so on Monday I'll talk about that a little bit.
Oh, you talked about it.
How we're actually using the Cannon to.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Yeah. So that was cool. Weird features in data. Also talked to Gail, because she's a spokesperson about the next generation Sloan 5. Old data, pencil beam, Apogee survey, totally revolutionary. New data, Sloan 5, not a photometric map, spectra. So we're really excited about that. And again, please talk to our students when they arrive, Adam, Kirsten, and Mariam. They'll be really interested to know what are the important physics-based questions of time domain data, why are they doing what they're doing. And Adam has his set of abundances. He has barium, europium, lithium. Is there anything that you can think to do with all of that? So what else do you want to talk about? That's all of the stuff that I prepared. Can you guys think of stuff to talk to them about? That would be great.
So there is some fundamental limit to the precision on any of these properties just from photon noise.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, and I know, you know, in order to estimate that, you have to use a model. You take mm-hmm. a model and take the derivative with respect to FEH,
yep.
divide by the error, sum inverse quadrature, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you shouldn't be able to do any better than that.
Correct.
Is that a test that you can try just to make sure you're not tricking yourself with the high precision?
Yep, so when Yuan Sen gives talks, he's developed the PAIN, which is a method to get precision abundances, and he will show ASCAP, the Canon, the PAIN, and the Kramer-Rao bound. And the PAIN's basically almost at the Kramer-Rao bound, which is this theoretical limit that's been calculated, and it does a little bit better than the Canon. So yeah, that's been calculated, and I don't know if it's in his papers, but he's definitely calculated that, and we find that he's almost there. He does better.
Have you tried using more than one label per star to look for binaries or spotted stars or something like that?
Oh, so Karim Al-Badri has labeled binary stars. He has a paper last year. It was beautiful, I thought, where he models, he basically finds he gets a better chi-squared fit for if he uses the two stars in binaries for this. And the paper labels 3,000 main sequence binary stars in Apogee, which are otherwise being thrown away. So yeah, I thought that was a really nice data-driven approach use of.
Yes. We have an eye for the exoplanet connection. In most of the plots, I didn't see a lot of the spectra going down to the end works.
Mm-hmm.
I think the last stops, it stopped pretty early. So what are the prospects of pushing this towards cooler dwarfs like the KNNs?
Does Gail know the answer to that? From Apogee, have they been working on the coolest dwarfs? Yeah. Okay.
Yes. It's going to be a long time before they're kind of at the level of the giants.
And that's just because the model atmosphere isn't up there.
Yeah.
There's actually a paper this week about magnetic effects on abundances. You can have magnetic enhancement in M dwarfs that makes the lines deeper, and you have to consider it in your model, and it's pretty significant.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
Who was the author?
This was from Carmenes.
Oh.
And Shuya, I think is her name, and at Max Planck and for solar system research.
Okay.
I put it on one of the hashtags.
Activity Zeeman splitting the lines.
It's weird. You have Zeeman splitting, but if you have a line that's saturated,
then the
Zeeman splitting is no longer saturated. So you change the whole curve of growth.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can, and I'm actually discovering that my plot for Friday. I'll show some of this. You can trick yourself into thinking you have a high abundance when actually you just have magnetic enhancement.
That's interesting.
So M dwarfs are very hard.
I mean, you could do something where you label them with labels that you invent, but how to tie that back
to... the state of the art now is to use the interferometry sample as a calibration to get temperatures and radii types. Using measured angular diameters and volumetric fluxes. The question is, that sample is small, so what's the, if you have a training sample of 50 stars, 20, and you want to apply it to thousands of spectra,
right.
That worked that well. But there are some fundamental things we know about it works.
In the power spectrum of the stars that you showed, some of the features I was wondering if they might originate from the window function of the data, like if you have gaps in the data or something. I'm wondering if you've thought about how to handle that.
Yeah, so do you mean the window function in generating the power spectra?
Mm-hmm.
I took the power spectra directly from the CASOC database. Where's Mikkel? Can you speak to that?
That might certainly be CASOC, but for the Kepler, the window function is so nice.
There's almost those.
Okay, yeah.
It shouldn't be an issue. I've also tried generating ACF from the light curve directly and just on the other, and it doesn't make too much difference.
What is the typical wavelength range of your model spectrum? You showed a sample of like 4,000, 8,000 angstroms or something, but what's your typical range for it?
It depends on the survey. Like from Apogee, it's 15,000 angstroms to 17,000, so 2,000 angstrom range. For Galar, I guess it's 4,000 angstroms. For the power spectrum, I'm working with 4 years of data, sampled every 30 minutes.
I'm thinking about, for those of us interested in climate model simulations, you know, often we need wavelength coverage from the near UV vis up to 2.5 microns at least, and for the M-dwarf spectra,
oh, right.
upwards of that preferably. So I'm just wondering how broad you
There are certainly a number of stars that have been observed by a multitude of different surveys, but they would just be the optical and infrared that I know of. It wouldn't cover. It would be hard to find a large subset of stars that cover everything from these surveys, I think.
Yeah, because those that live on the Virtual Planet Laboratory spectral database, I don't know if you're familiar with that, VPL, it's Vicky Meadows out of University of Washington, has sort of a set of spectra that's empirical, and I think it's like a combination of kind of hodgepodge of different, but she's able to get from, I think, near UV up to the near IR. But I'm just wondering how she's done that compared to what you're doing.
Yeah, here. I'll have to have a look at it and see what the origin of the information is. It'd be really interesting.
The first part of the talk, it seemed like this gave a big improvement if you have a survey that has like a bunch of low resolution spectra. At what point does it become less helpful in terms of like the number of spectra? Like if you had a few high resolution spectra, it wouldn't be as helpful, but like where's the cutoff?
I think the cutoff is where you don't want to do it by hand. Like, you know, people will do, like Thomas Bensby's analyzed thousands of stars by hand and he's happy. Like equivalent, and it's a beautiful sample. But I think at the point, it's really up to like whenever you want to have a good automated method to get your abundance information. So I don't think that's a one particular answer. I think if you have 20 stars, you should just probably do it by hand. Yeah.
Just one quick big picture question. And that when you have the two Venn diagrams of the two surveys,
yeah.
What are the prospects for training one sample to predict another sample where the circles don't overlap?
You tell me how to do it.
I don't know. So you have a survey of giants,
yeah.
Like what Ruth and I are trying to do with abundance, age abundance, and you apply it to dwarfs, where you have no overlapping spectrum,
yeah.
But you might have overlapping other things.
Like what?
Abundances. That's an example. But they're measured in different ways.
Oh, I think there's probably things you can do. It'll be hard. I think everyone should have said spectrum common.
Yeah.
That would be. I sort of see what you're saying. Like you have some sort of partial hodgepodge of label overlap and.
Maybe there's a systematic offset between two surveys. Yeah. Like what if you didn't have any overlap between Lemost and Apogee? Could you assume there's a systematic difference and then.
I wouldn't like to do it that way. I think
it's not data driven, I guess, at that point.
I think at that point, you know, they kind of do that. They plot. Yeah, at the moment, that's how things have been done. They fit lines. People fit lines to trends for clusters and try and correct.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Melissa, again.